I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to The Connection. Almost 60 years ago, in 1964, President Johnson declared a war on poverty during his State of the Union address.
Many Americans live on the outskirts of hope, some because of their poverty and some because of their color, and all too many because of both. Our task is to help replace their despair with opportunity. And this administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
Today, tens of millions of Americans live in poverty, and the poorest tend to live in the rural South, in the tobacco and cotton belts in southern Texas and in Appalachia. Our guests, acclaimed sociologists and leading poverty researchers, Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson, explore why these regions are so disadvantaged and how this legacy of poverty has torn communities apart. Many are struggling with addiction, unemployment, violence, corruption, and isolation, a loss of community and connection. Their new book is The Injustice of Place. We'll talk about how these regions have been exploited and local efforts to bring people together to solve problems. Catherine Eden is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, director of the Center for Research on Child and Family Well-Being. She's co-author of this book, The Injustice of Place, and wrote almost 10 years ago an acclaimed book titled a book called $2 a Day, Living on Virtually Nothing in America. And Catherine Eden, nice to have you back with us.
Thank you, Marty.
Also with us, Timothy Nelson. He's a sociologist, director of undergraduate studies at Princeton University, and one of the authors of this book, The Injustice of Place. His previous research has been on low-income fathers, Doing the Best I Can, the title of his book. And Timothy Nelson, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
Catherine, let me begin with you. How much of a person's place or their zip code determines their income, their education, their employment, their health, their overall well-being in America?
So it's really striking, Marty. We've learned recently that where you live, where you grow up, can be as consequential for you as your genes, your behaviors, the quality of health care in your community, community both at the neighborhood level and at the larger level, a city, a county, is tremendously consequential for your later life outcomes.
Has it always been this way, or is this a more exacerbated problem?
You know, I don't think we know the answer to that question because we don't have the data going back that we do right now. Our nation's big data infrastructure is really ramped up in ways that are allowing us to ask unprecedented questions. But I think the new frontier is going back into time to try to see whether we can reconstruct some of the data that allow us to tell the story of the power of place today.
You know, Timothy, I'm sure a lot of people would think, oh, no, it's urban America. That's where the poverty is. We're talking in Philadelphia, which is the largest poor city in the country. But nonetheless, where you found this deep poverty were in, you know, these sort of legacy slavery states of the Deep South, of southern Texas, of Appalachia.
Yeah, as we say in the book, that we, most of our lives have been urban sociologists, have studied Philadelphia and Camden and places like that. When we put this index of deep disadvantage together, which is what the book is based on, and it's really at the county level and also the 500 largest cities, and we put it all on a map to look at what the patterning was, and lo and behold, it was the very places that you mentioned, right, which led us to not only send researchers into these areas and do some deep ethnographic kind of work and interview study, but also to drive. Some of the book is just kind of a travelogue of us driving around and really getting a look at what these places are like.
I mean, it is interesting that we're talking largely, Catherine, about the South. Why is that? I mean, that's a large question.
Yeah, so the Index of Deep Disadvantage combines measures of poverty with measures of health and measures of mobility. We use machine learning to put those together and create these rankings. And the reason these places are in the South is that in many ways, the 14 southern states and the commodities they've produced have been the foundation of wealth in America. So we're talking coal, tobacco, cotton, and the first irrigated vegetable farms, spinach, onions, all of the staples that end up on American tables were first produced in these sort of single commodity economies in the South. And it is in many ways those economies and the social relations, the extremely exploitative social relations that grew up around these industries that create the legacy these places are struggling with today.
Well, and what you describe in this book, Timothy, is exploitation. These, you know, we think of big tobacco, big cotton coming into these areas where, of course, that's where the resources are. But just extracting not just the resources, but also destroying some of these communities.
Yeah, a lot of these places were founded essentially on, as Kathy said, these single commodities tied to international and local markets. We actually use a phrase in the book, internal colonies, to kind of capture what this exploitative relation was like. And people might say, well, capitalism alone is kind of exploitative, but these places are so deeply and intensively exploitative and extracted, I think they're sort of qualitatively different from what happened in other areas. And we look particularly at the upper Midwest as a place which kind of has a lot of the opposite dynamics, although obviously very rural.
Yeah, and I do want to get to that. But let me go back to something that you both have said, and this is also a big part of the book. You talk about disadvantage versus poverty. Explain the difference and why it's important to think differently, perhaps even about poverty.
Well, when we were embedding researchers in these communities and they were living and participating in the communities, we'd have these weekly meetings, and someone would say, did you know Clay County, Kentucky, was the salt mining capital of the region by 1820? And then we'd hear, did you know Marion County was at the height of tobacco production for its entire region? And another researcher would say, did you know that it's in LaFleur County, Mississippi, where cotton really gained its greatest ascendancy after the Civil War? And so on. And so we started thinking, how can all of these places we chose at random from a map be the capital, world capital of something? And this is what sent us to the history books. And as we were learning about the extraction and the exploitation in these places, we felt we had no choice but to move from a poverty frame to a disadvantage frame, because disadvantage implies it's a moral term. It implies that people have been held back unfairly. And this being held back unfairly was really what we were seeing in the histories of these places.
I'm sure some people think and say, and I've heard some people say this, that the reason people are poor is because of their own fault. They make bad choices and that they pay the consequences, Timothy, for these bad choices. You're pushing back on that in this book.
You don't choose where you're born, or in most cases, where you grow up. So I think that is the dominant American narrative about poverty. Mm-hmm. And in terms of choice, I've seen some comments to the book about, well, if these places are so bad, why don't people just move away from them? Mm-hmm. And in fact, they are very depopulated. People have moved back and oftentimes have had to come back because they didn't find things much better in the major urban areas they've tried out.
Because these are communities, right? I mean, as poor as they might be and as disadvantaged as they might be, this is where people grew up.
Exactly. And their family is there. People need networks, especially when you're living in poverty, to survive. You can't just do it on your own.
I mean, it is interesting to look at some of this history and this even the legacy, Catherine, of slavery and Jim Crow, because when you look at the South and a lot of these places, you go to sharecropping and subsistence farming and tenant farmers, so that even if people are making money around you, so many of the workers were not.
What's fascinating about these places is they were like feudal economies, a tiny cadre of haves. Often heavily indebted to Eastern banks. Nobody is not a part of this story, right? And banks in New York and London. And then a vast population of highly exploited workers. And not only were they exploited for their labor, they were denied suffrage. This persisted until the 60s and 70s through vote buying. It persists today. So, the story of the feudal structure that you see when you have haves, have-nots, and no one in the middle is very striking and really characterizes the U-shaped economies of these places even today.
And you even describe some of these communities where on one side of town are mansions and people living very well. The other side of the town, the roads aren't paved. You know, the houses don't have, you know, electricity.
Or latrines. Yeah. So I think this is why driving to as many of these places as we could, we visited 175 of the 200 most disadvantaged counties on our road trip, is because the revelation that these places were not uniformly poor was richly on display. Mm. So you'd see antebellum mansions or, you know, ranches in South Texas, or, you know, the houses on the hill in the former mining communities of Clay County. And then you would see the shacks.
Yeah.
And oftentimes they were cheek to jowl with one another and remain so today. So these places still are places of great affluence and great poverty. In fact, they're some of the most unequal places. Mm. There is an unequal or even more unequal is Chicago, Los Angeles, or New York.
Well, and we're almost coming to break here, Tim, but I mean, that's America, isn't it? This deep divide between rich and poor.
And it doesn't have to be, I think. I mean, and that's what, in the end of the book, we really targeting these very disadvantaged places. We have some very specific policy proposals for how we can address those things in, using the big data infrastructure that we have now and all the research that we've done.
So, I mean, I'm sure some people listening to us now think, oh, my God, you know, this is such a depressing conversation. And I should say that we will get to that after a very short break. And let me just make sure our listeners know who we are talking today on The Connection. Our guests are Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson. They happen to be married to each other, I should say that. And they have co-authored along with a third writer, Luke Schaefer, a book called The Injustice of Place. And it's subtitled Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. And they both are professors at Princeton University and have been doing this work having to do with sociology and also poverty for a long, long time. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Where are the poorest places in the country, in rural America, in Appalachia, in southern Texas, the cotton and tobacco belts of the Deep South? Today on the show, we're talking about the impact of extreme poverty on some of these rural communities, the legacy of exploitation, and why we should care. And again, our guests are Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson, and their book is called The Injustice of Place. Let me play another clip, and this is Robert F. Kennedy touring Eastern Kentucky in February of 1968. And this was a month before he declared his run for the presidency. For 2 days, he toured to see if Johnson's quote-unquote war on poverty was helping people in Appalachia.
Well, people are still having a very, very difficult time. There is a hunger, considerable hunger in this part of the country. There's no real hope for the future amongst many of these people who worked hard in the coal mines. And now that the coal mines shut down, they have no place to go. There's no hope for the future. There's no industry moving in. The men are trained in government programs and there's no jobs at the end of the training program because of the cutback, because of the demands on our federal budget in Washington, the war in Vietnam. Even these training programs are being cut back, and so people are being cut off, and they have no place to turn. And so they're desperate and filled with despair. It seems to me that this country is wealthy as we are. This is an intolerable condition. It reflects on all of us. We can do things all over the rest of the world, but I think we should do something for our people here in this, in our own country.
Catherine, he uses the word despair several times. Have things improved since 1968?
So they have. It's absolutely incontrovertible that more people have, have toilets in their homes. There's less crowding. The health conditions have improved. We can't deny that there has been progress, but in these places, the very places that gave the war on poverty its face, the very places where Johnson and Kennedy toured on their various poverty tours, these are the places where it didn't happen, ironically. The agenda, I think, maybe got diverted because of civil unrest, of the things going on in the nation. But it is in these places that we need to launch a new war on poverty with a relentless focus on the places still in the greatest need.
Well, let's talk about Appalachia, Tim. Mm-hmm. And you describe this, and I don't think there's any argument here. The sickest part of the country is in Appalachia. The state of opioid use, of abuse, of deaths, really targeted, as we are learning, by Big Pharma, by the Sacklers and OxyContin. One of the people that you talk to in a region of Appalachia says there is nothing to do here but drugs. I mean, these are communities that have been hollowed out, and we hear the currently, the deaths of despair. The people are so despairing, they can't live.
Yeah, so not only was this region targeted by Big Pharma for a number of reasons, but it was especially vulnerable because of the loss of what we call social infrastructure in the book, following sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. And so these are the local places of gathering, churches, bowling alleys,
community
restaurants.
Centers.
Yeah. And so when people have this type of connection to one another through these public gathering spaces, sometimes called third places and so on, it really is a protective thing for them. And when those things disappear, then it leaves people vulnerable to all types of bad outcomes.
Yeah. I mean, why, it seems like such a dumb question, McCatherine, but why are they so vulnerable? I mean, companies come and go, things change. Sometimes people can adapt. Sometimes it's just harder. Why does this seem so intractable?
So the economies of these internal colonies really persisted, held on until the mid to late 60s. And in those years, these communities were ripe with, movie theaters, bowling alleys, roller rinks. There was, the tradition of going to the Saturday matinee. Of course, there was racial segregation in all cases. And that's important to figure out. The company towns even provided golf courses for their white miners. And this all began to collapse at once. But then as depopulation started really affecting these regions, all of these businesses began to close down. And so the very places where communities build the bonds that catch people where they fall mm-hmm. were dying. And we were able to show empirically, going back to big data, that losing your social infrastructure had as strong of an impact on opioid deaths as did more commonly recognized factors like the loss of employment. So there's at least speculative evidence that this really matters, that creating places to build connections, the theme of your show,
right,
is vital. And that's almost a recipe for some of the solutions then that we propose in the end of the book.
Well, I wonder too, when you toured these communities, did you see signs of community coming back, of connections coming back, of building community centers, of schools taking a more central role in people's lives?
Well, unfortunately,
yes and no, probably.
We did the tour we started the tour right before the pandemic, so that obviously had a huge impact on, you know, these institutions and their ability to stay open and so on. So we haven't been back since the pandemic to a lot of them. So I would hope that we could go back and find, exactly as you're saying, signs of new life in these places. And especially since with some of the federal programs, a lot of it is targeted toward rural areas. And so we've been in discussion with people in the administration about how to best target these particular areas and support social infrastructure.
Go ahead, Catherine.
Well, I did want to point out that later on in the show, we'll hear from Dr. Boyd Chow, and she's a really important figure, bringing a charter school to Greenwood, Mississippi.
Yeah.
But there are many like her, people who grew up in the community, often people of color, who've gone on and been incredibly successful in their careers. But they've come home to their communities. And I think we see this especially in the Cotton Belt in South Texas, determined to give back. And so there's a whole new cadre of leaders who are resuscitating historic community centers, determined to start anti-violence programs. Violence is a huge problem in America's internal colonies. Doing things that really bring the expertise they've gained elsewhere back to their communities. So in some ways, I think these communities have reached such a low ebb that it's created room for innovators like Dr. Boyd Chow to come in and do something really meaningful. And in our interviews, we were really stunned by the amount of support that these new leaders were getting from all swaths of the community.
I mean, that's really good to know. You know, I was thinking, you know, it's hard to get away from the pandemic. But during the pandemic, we actually reduced child poverty. There was the expanded child tax credit, which is substantially, I'm not sure, Catherine, how much it reduced child poverty, but by really
unbelievable,
a measurable amount. Congress did not renew it, so it went away. But what is the lesson there?
Yeah, so we really worked hard on advocating for the expanded child tax credit. And that, along with the stimulus payments, reduced poverty and hardship in America to a stunning degree. We can solve this. And it's especially important in America's internal colonies to have these sort of federal programs that reward parenting. We need people to have kids. Our fertility rates are falling to a frightening degree, and we need them to be able to raise them well to support us as we age. So what we saw there was that a simple solution could make huge inroads, and it has the advantage of avoiding corruption, which we also found was rife in these communities. And so you can circumvent the elite capture of federal dollars by paying families directly.
But isn't that also part of the problem of dealing with poverty in America? Is you start a program and then you stop it.
Yes.
Fund it and then you defund it. I mean, there's a whole history here of that's how we have approached poverty.
That's true. And I wanted to amplify something Kathy said. I think it's easy, especially from sort of an urban center, to look at a rural county, for example, and think all those, you know, first of all, it's a very flat social structure, which, as Kathy already said, is not true. There's the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah.
But also that division colors everything in these communities. So the war on poverty, one great feature of it is it had this requirement for maximum feasible participation of the poor. Interestingly, the Clay County Community Action Program was actually defunded because it couldn't meet that requirement, because the local elites were so entrenched and so determined not to change the social hierarchy that they actually lost their federal dollars. So these kind of direct programs to families, which bypass that whole sort of situation are really important.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And today on The Connection, we're talking with Timothy Nelson and Catherine Eden, who have co-authored, along with Luke Schaefer, a new book called The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. We will be talking about schools, but there's also a stream of racism and white supremacy in this book as well. And as you write, when there was Brown versus the Board of Education and the integration of schools, a lot of these communities put together these academies, these private academies, largely to keep black students out. And you quote someone in 1966. His name is Simmons. What's his first name?
Tut Patterson.
Oh, Tut Patterson. Okay. So writing in The Citizen, he writes, "Parents want their children to be raised and educated free from the tensions of racial conflict in the classroom, free from the frustrating drag of mass mediocrity, and free from the blight of self-styled progressive educators whose avowed aim is to turn young Americans from the established inheritance of their fathers to alien theories of collectivism and anti-white racism." Now, I have heard that today, you know,
right,
at school board meetings. And here, this is 1966.
Yeah. So when Brown was passed, Southern states were tremendously, especially in the cotton and tobacco belts, tremendously successful at resisting these orders. In fact, nothing happened for 10 or even 15 years in Little Rock, Arkansas. It went on even longer. But when these white citizens' councils, which were founded to resist integration, began realizing, you know, the Voting Rights Act and the all of this new legislation was coming, they began to stand up these segregation academies. In fact, in the magazine, The Citizen, offering step-by-step instructions, and thousands of these segregation academies, which were whites-only, explicitly sprung up all across the South. As many as 750 kids, I think by 1970, white children had left the public schools and were enrolled in these all-white academies.
750,000.
One
thing that's shocked us in our road trip is that we saw many of these places continuing to flourish. And in fact, in Arkansas, with the Learns Act, many students will now be attending segregation academies on the public dime.
Wow. But as someone that looks at history, Tim, I mean, if we don't know our history, or we whitewash it, or we ignore it, or we, you know, brush it under the rug, we're not going to be a functioning democracy, but we're also not going to be able to solve these problems.
Yeah, it's often painful. I learned a lot doing the historical research for this book. A lot of stuff that I wish I didn't know about our country. But especially in these places, the harshness with which the local establishment and elites kept a lid on their subjugated population, and not just in the Cotton Belt, which is more well-known, but South Texas had its own, you know, essentially Jim Crow institutions there, with the all-white primary, with certain labor controls and you know, just violence used to keep people in place. And in Appalachia, basically, the miners had no freedom of choice in terms they were told who to vote for, which often was a company-selected person. If they were fired, they would lose their home because it was a company town. Mm-hmm. And the threat of that really kept people in line for a long time.
I mean, that's a powerful legacy.
Yes, it is. So you might think that, you might ask yourself, why didn't people revolt?
And what we have a chapter
about
that.
It turns out that revolt is in the DNA of these places. These were also places that were the literal cradle, in each case, of civil rights. But the elites are very, very successful in retribution. We can't disclaim the great strides that were made. You know, Greenwood, Mississippi was where Freedom Summer was launched. Mm-hmm. There was a tremendous civil rights activity in South Texas. And essentially, it got people the right to vote. But nonetheless, these communities have continued to suffer because of the white retribution, the elite retribution that often follow these acts of resistance.
You both have mentioned violence, and I mean, this is a serious problem, obviously, across the country. A lot of the focus is on cities, on Philadelphia, what happens in this city or Trenton or any of our listening area. But you say, take a look at rural violence. And Tim, I don't know if it's greater than urban violence or how different it is, but it's a really serious problem.
Well, what we did was we looked at the best kind of CDC data for this, for deaths due to interpersonal violence. And actually, LaFleur County, Mississippi, which is the home of Greenwood, which we were, is actually more violent than Chicago, right?
It doesn't get near the coverage or attention.
Right. So we do a thing in the book where we chronicle in a short time period of about 6 months using the local newspaper all of the homicides in the area, and it's really, really a problem.
Well, and these are places where people know each other, and I assume a lot of interpersonal violence is about relationships.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We got to know one community leader in Greenwood, Lavoris Weathers, who helped with Shun Peterson, another activist, launch an anti-violence campaign in the summer that we were doing our field work there. And our researcher, Ryan Parsons, was there observing all of these events. There were barbecues, and they were giving out surveys. And what's the biggest problem in the community? Overwhelming numbers of people in the black part of town said it was violence. Oh. And violence was making them hunker down in their homes. It was keeping them from forming social connections because they were literally too afraid to go to an event like the famed Southern Christmas parades.
Wow.
So, but... we also found through going back again to big data that what was sparking the violence was actually the lack of mobility in the place. And Lavoris Weathers.
People were stuck there, you mean?
Yes, Lavoris Weathers was the first person to put us onto this. He said, it's not interpersonal beefs, it's hunger.
Literally.
It's hunger. And we called this the hunger hypothesis. And again, going back to the very best data available, we are able to demonstrate that the lack of mobility in a place sparks violence.
Mm. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation here on The Connection here in Philadelphia on WHYY. And again, talking with sociologist Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson, who have co-authored a new book called The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. And the book is about parts of this country. They tend to be in the South, the Deep South, Southern Texas as well, also in Appalachia. And they also talk about a bit on Indian reservations as well. We're going to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is WHYY in Philadelphia. You're listening to The Connection. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson about their book, The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. We were talking about violence right before the break, and you interviewed a woman named Ebony, and she describes, Catherine, all the people in her life who have been killed or dead.
Yeah, I remember going. She lives in a motel, as many poor folk do in Greenwood. And we crowded into her room, and she took out this file and poured it out on the bed and began just going through death certificates and obituaries, newspaper reports, pointing out person after person in her immediate circle who had died. And then the scene ends with the newspaper report of the arrest and incarceration of her son, who is also accused, though he denies it, of another one of these murders of someone the family had known.
I mean, this is trauma. This is war in a lot of ways, Tim. We're talking about war zones for so many people.
It was really striking, and certainly something we did not expect to find as we left the city and went out into the rural areas. But such a striking part of what people have to live with.
And some are dealing with it. I mean, some, Catherine, are figuring out how to address the problem of violence. I mean, this is a nationwide problem.
Yeah. So what's interesting, kind of like the Nothing to Do But Drugs chapter of the book, is that people are realizing that young people need hope. They need a sense of the future. In this area of Mississippi, there are a couple of so-called freedom schools. In fact, Ryan Parson is writing a book about one of these freedom schools that are really trying to help young people realize a larger future. So that there are small efforts. I think the Floyd Legacy Academy middle school in town that Tamela Boyd Shaw founded is one of these sort of mobility engines that are coming into the community and sort of shaking things up. One problem, of course, is that the economies of these places are very flat. So if you have a high school degree in Greenwood, your best job is going to be on the factory floor at Milwaukee Tool, where you're not going to make very much money. Yeah. Because that's why Milwaukee Tool's not in Milwaukee, is because it can pay people half the amount it pays Milwaukee workers in Greenwood. So they have, once you give kids wings, they need places to soar, and the economies really have to shift. It can't just be the nonprofits giving kids hope.
Well, you've given me a perfect segue to introduce our third guest, and that's Catherine Eden and Timothy Nelson. And again, we are talking about their book, The Injustice of Place, and they did travel the country. They went to Greenwood, Mississippi, and one of the people that they met there is Dr. Tamela Boyd Shaw. She grew up there, moved back to found a charter school, the LaFleur Legacy Academy, and she told Catherine and Tim that she wanted to give students a better education than the one that she got, and a chance for a better life. And Dr. Tamela Boyd Shaw, nice to have you with us on The Connection. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. I am happy to be here.
Well,
thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. You graduated from the city's all-black high school. This is, as I understand it, according to our guests, you were near the top of your class. As you look back, what kind of education did you get?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I did graduate from Amanda Elsie High School, class of 92, as salutatorian, missed valedictorian by just a tenth of a point.
Oh, dear.
And that memory still remains with me today.
Yes, I can tell.
Yeah, so, but yes, as I noted, went through the interview, I know I got the very best education that the school could offer at the time. Unfortunately, as I continued to matriculate through school, college, and through my master's program, and even my doctoral program, I learned that my education was lackluster at best. Despite Star Student and all of the different awards that I received while in high school, once I got to college, I learned that I was only, as I phrase it, Greenwood smart, and I wasn't able to compete in a way that was academically telling with my colleagues, with my friends, with my peers once I got to college. So I spent lots and lots and lots of time in the library studying, reading, and just trying to catch up so that I can keep up and even get ahead. And that is something that I vowed that I wanted to do for children in Greenwood and the surrounding areas so that they would have even better opportunities than I did.
And I do want to get to all of that, but just to underscore your experience, Dr. Shaw, was it that you had outdated books or you didn't have the, chemistry sets or the kind of supplies that, let's say, the white schools in Greenwood had?
Yes, this is how I would put it. I didn't know. You don't know what you don't know.
Right.
So I didn't know at that time that the materials with which we had access, you know, or how we were working with those were so outdated, except for one day I realized you may remember textbooks having where you write the student's name in it. And so went down, it's like, oh, so many people had this book before I did, oh, wow. 10, sometimes 15 years ago, whether they were in that particular school district or it came from another school district. So it was really telling, like I said, once I graduated high school, but the access to materials that I have seen in schools across the country in my adult life, I definitely didn't have then. And it's sad to say a lot of that still exists in our small town today, in terms of access to the very best resources. I have a good friend who lives in Houston, Texas, in the Woodlands area, and her daughter is in middle school, and her school has a swimming pool at the school and those kinds of things. So, and she left Mississippi, she and her husband, and moved for professional reasons, but also wanted to think about the opportunities that her child would have as a Black student. And that is really telling as well. But from my own experience, it was just the lack of opportunity, the lack of access to resources. And here at LaFleur Legacy Academy, we are trying our best through philanthropic opportunities and other resources to make this narrative different for children of the same demographics.
Let me just go quickly back to you, Catherine, because both you and Tim write about this sort of separate but equal idea, but it was never equal. It was separate but unequal.
Yeah, and when we look at the history of schooling before Brown, it's I think many people will find it jaw-dropping. But after Brown as well, and as you said, continuing today, and a really wonderful economist, Rucker Johnson from Berkeley, has done really innovative research showing that when Black and white students coexist in integrated classrooms for a sustained amount of time, you can literally see the Black-white achievement gap fade. Hmm. So segregation is bad for Black kids' achievement. They do better in integrated classrooms, in part because white students always command better resources, as Dr. Boyd-Schott was saying, not because white students are, you know, special in any way, but because they come packaged with resources given our society. But we also know that in those same classrooms, white students don't suffer at all. Hmm. So in some ways, the choices we have made, and as you know now, American schools are as segregated as they were in the 60s, as we make choices to resegregate in all kinds of nefarious ways, private schools are a big part of this. It is to the detriment of our children.
Dr. Shaw, let me go back to you, and even going back to this LaFleur Legacy Academy, wanting to create an environment, a place where children can learn and be their best selves. That's hard, isn't it?
It absolutely is hard when we have scholars and we intentionally call them scholars so that we can attempt to change the mindset and their ultimate trajectory in life. But it is especially hard when scholars are here with us 7 hours a day, sometimes 8. We have an extended school day and after school tutorials a couple of days of the week to try to continue impacting that achievement level. But it's hard because when they go back into, whether it's a home environment or a community environment that doesn't emphasize the things that we emphasize with our core values of excellence, empowerment, and enjoyment, it is particularly hard. And we're a middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. And anyone who does great research knows it takes at least 3 years to see change. And with that 3 years that we have with scholars, we're trying our very best to do that both academically and socially. So not having access to different resources makes it particularly hard, but that is why we try to open up what we call learning excursions to all of our scholars in a way that they would be introduced to different opportunities that they otherwise would not have. And if I may, just like a quick example, sure. There is a Yale program, Young Emerging Leaders, that the Chamber of Commerce here sponsors. And it's for high school students. And they being the chamber, are really intentional about making the program as diversified as possible. Unfortunately, it doesn't end up being totally diverse for the reason that you named. One is that the white children in the program come with parents, counselors, teachers who are immediately going to recommend them for the program. And unfortunately, the Black kids, it's always, oh, we had to send it to the school three times, or we haven't gotten any response. And it's just really heartbreaking to me. And I just want to go out there and say, look, there are so many kids who are eligible for this. Let's make it happen. Right. So what we did, we asked if middle schoolers could be a part of it, because I know I could feel it with all positions of Black kids with scholars from my school, but there weren't the resources there. So we wrote a grant. I said, there has to be funding out here for this. And we want to now become a part of that program where we can start in middle school, equipping scholars with the necessary exposure and opportunities to actually emerge as leaders in the community. So I'm just not that person that want to talk about it. I think it's so important that we have people.
I get it. I feel it. No, I think that's great. You know, you said something and I scribbled it down. You talked about it for your scholars' empowerment, but you also used the word enjoyment. And yes. I thought that was really interesting. And this show is called The Connection. So we're looking for relationships and collaboration. And I wonder how critical you think enjoyment is. Thanks to you, Dr. Shaw.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. You all can see my face right now. If kids don't enjoy going to school every day, they're not going to learn anything. I don't care how well taught it is. So it is the reason why we want that joy factor in our school day. And what we teach, preach, and act is, you've got to be entertaining to scholars. You've got to make sure that they are enjoying every day. One of the things that we do here at Legacy is at the end of each day, our teachers have these index cards where the last 3 minutes, the scholar's exit ticket, what did you enjoy about school today? And I ask my leadership team, we huddle for 10, 15 minutes. Let's run through some of these cards, see what they enjoyed so we can continue doing those things. And seeing if a scholar did not enjoy the day, we need to talk with that scholar. We need to figure out what's going on. They absolutely have to enjoy the day. We as adults, we want to do what we enjoy. Kids need that as well.
Well, I would love to get one of those tickets. I think that that would all help us all. I wanted to, and I'm looking at you, Tim, and I'm also looking at the clock here, but we're in such a fight about schools and about curriculum and, you know, these what seem like sort of inane arguments when there are so many critical issues that we have to address in terms of our children and the future.
Yeah, so schools are just so vitally important to creating places of opportunity. But schools cannot by themselves overcome the deep structural disadvantages of, you know, that we've created in society between racial groups, between the haves and the have-nots, and as our book points out, between places which have more resources and places which have really never had the resources that they've needed.
Well, even thinking about Philadelphia, you know, how much per student versus the suburbs. I mean, that's not to blame the suburbs, but they invest a lot more money per student than a poor-ish city does.
Yeah. You know, and one other thing I wanted to bring up is that Greenwood is kind of plagued, in a way, by the plethora of schools due to the refusal of whites to be in the same classrooms as blacks. And so we see a huge contrast, though, in South Texas, where whites fled. And so you didn't see this bifurcation of education in the way you do in much of the Deep South and the Tobacco Belt. And what's really interesting there is the school becomes this powerful source of social infrastructure and connection. Andy Guerrero, who's the principal of one of the elementary schools there, Tomas Rivera, says, I lead a campus of joy. And, you know, there's a new high school. It has a new auditorium, sorely needed. And the school's band is, as one of the counselors told us, is the pride point of the town. And the whole community comes together to hear this marching band and to celebrate all of the achievements in the school. Elsewhere in South Texas, whenever there's someone in trouble, there's a GoFundMe that goes up. We also studied a community in Brooks County, Texas, where this was just going on all the time. But again, organized around the school, its bands, and its academic achievement. So if you don't have separate and highly unequal, you can actually find an institution that every town has and ensure that that institution creates the connections that help people thrive.
Well, that's a perfect place to end our conversation, although we could go on.
We could.
We could. But my thanks to all three of you for joining us today on The Connection. Dr. Tamla Boyd-Shaw, thank you so much, and thank you so much for the work that you're doing in Greenwood, Mississippi.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she's the head of LaFleur Legacy Academy. Catherine Eden, thank you for coming in. Nice talking with you again.
It was a joy, as always.
And same to you, Timothy Nelson.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And their book is called The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. And they are sociologists who are experts in this thing called poverty in America. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. The senior producer of the show is Debbie Bilder. Paige Murray-Bessler produces The Connection. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.